Hello there, and a very good morning to you. Very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. We'll start today with the Sunday Times, and their main headline says, "Revealed plot to seize control from British PM." And it's quite an extensive article by Tim Shipman on the various manoeuvrings and plottings that are going on in the House of Commons particularly. Top official rapt for breaking High Court window. This is an extraordinary story about Edmund Honan, who's been in here with us, was responsible for breaking internal windows because the place was so stuffy. Now, that's what you expect in law libraries, isn't it? Stuffiness. Now, secret codes reveal smugglers 100 million. Living costs now at Celtic Tiger levels. And her name was Dawn Croke. A very nice article by Brendan O'Connor about that tragic story, that woman that died and in the process saved the small child in Donegal. Sunday Business Post. Fianna Fáil attacks government and claims the country is not prepared for a no-deal Brexit. Tensions between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil over preparations for Brexit. On to the Mail on Sunday. Fury as Leo leaves his, quote, in inverted commas, unclean women out. And this is on his trip to Ethiopia, where they do kind of operate on second century rules in these matters. But anyway, the Mirror, Kinahan boss held in UK raid. Sunday World, bomber in UK arrest, and the Irish Sun, con the dole. This is about people in prison getting dole. So there are headlines. And with us in studio this morning are Mary Whelan, who is a diplomat, most recently ambassador to Austria and the Netherlands, Fergal Hickey, consultant in emergency medicine in Sligo University Hospital, Fia Kelly, deputy political editor of the Irish Times, Ray Bassett was Irish diplomat, most recently ambassador to Canada, and Gráinne Healy, public affairs consultant. And you are all very, very welcome indeed. Let's get the unclean out of the way first, Gráinne. What did you make of that?
Well, I think, you know, it's an extraordinary headline, but the truth is that the women had part of the delegation, very senior women, some of them assistant secretaries and other people who are used to getting doors opened for them and hooshed in. I think, you know, Leo would have known about this before he went. His team would have okayed the itinerary. They knew exactly what they were doing. So while on the one hand, you know, you can scoff at it, the truth is for the Prime Minister of Ireland, which has such good equality legislation, to be going somewhere that he ends up leaving the women outside the door, you know, a bit of an error.
One of them being an ambassador, Mary, with wearing your former hat.
I probably wouldn't get so upset about it, really. First of all, I presume it was the ambassador who made all the arrangements for the trip. I presume that she recommended he would go to this very sacred place. And I think the story should be amazing. Irish Prime Minister goes abroad with a very senior female delegation.
It does come on the back, though, of recent controversy just in the last week or two about attendance by Irish ministers and officials at events in the US about St. Patrick's
Day.
Men-only events. And the Taoiseach defended that as well and said you have to be in the room to change minds. So you just wonder, you know, is there accumulation of these type of stories? You know, it seems that on occasion the Taoiseach goes away on foreign trips, and by all accounts, this one this week was very successful, but there seems to be always something that erupts on the trips when the Taoiseach is out of the country, apart from Brussels, where he goes over, and it's all Brexit, Brexit, Brexit. But aside from that, we had the Trump lunch, we had the Downing Street, Love Actually, and there's always a few bits and bobs. You just wonder, on the back of the US story, will this cause a bit of damage as well?
Right. They are the rules there. I mean, you don't have to agree with them or anything. But I mean, I know of people who have gone there because they're fantastically interesting places to go. And as you say, it was probably the ambassador who set it all up.
And I would distinguish between something like that place, which was the religious authorities were the ones who presumably took that decision, or the guardians of that place. And one could cause serious offence, I think, by insisting on our norms and standards and attending or not attending an all-male event in a Western democracy. I think there is a substantive difference there.
Yeah.
Ray?
Well, on this, I agree completely with Mary. And, you know, when I was in Canada, I regularly helped to set up women's groups, Irish women's groups around, which didn't have males going to it. I know it's not exactly the same thing, but I think sometimes we can be a bit too easy to take insult. And on this, as I say, the Ambassador Sonia Hyland, Helen Blake was there as well, Assistant Secretary. They're very senior, very influential, and I'm quite certain that they would have been involved in the planning. And if they felt that this was an insult to themselves, they certainly wouldn't have gone there. And so I think, you know, where do you draw the line? Do you go to Saudi Arabia? Do you go to China because of its human rights record? There's a point at which you have to live in the realpolitik, and this is part of it.
Right, OK. Last word, Fergal.
I tend to agree with my diplomat colleagues, but I think the issue about going to the US and going to many only events, I think that's something that could be addressed.
That's a different
It's a different animal.
Yeah. OK, we will leave that there for the moment. And guess what we will be talking about in the next little while. Ray, I think you're the only person that came through the world of diplomacy that thinks we're doing this all wrong.
I wouldn't say that, but I'm certainly in a minority. No, from the very start, I said I believed the backstop was a very, very bad idea. It had a lot of drawbacks. I thought that it greatly endangered the Good Friday Agreement, unlike people who are going around claiming that they want to save the Good Friday Agreement by introducing the backstop. I also think that it greatly increased the possibility of a no deal, because there was no way from the very start that the UK could have accepted essentially the backstop in the format that we and the European Union were pushing.
But they did.
They didn't. They extended it to the whole of the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
But we were pressing it on the basis that it would apply only to Northern Ireland, which I think breached the Good Friday Agreement. And I also think that it there was no real chance very early on. It now looks as if this is going to be defeated, maybe even on a historically big vote. There's some talk that it may be defeated by over 200 votes. And I think it's going to do an awful lot of damage. And remember, the Good Friday Agreement is based on relationships. At the very core of the Good Friday Agreement is the relationship between Dublin and London. The only people who signed the Good Friday Agreement was Bertie Ahern and Tony Blair. I think by pushing this in as aggressive a form as we're doing, we're endangering the trust and the relationship that's being built up. And you can see in the papers today, everywhere there's a certain sort of a general theme of trying to get blame. We have Micheál Martin now starting to blame the Taoiseach, because this was meant to be a great triumph. It now looks as if it could be a big failure, and everybody's running for cover. The stories about the politicians taking control in Westminster is clearly being put out by number 10. When you see stories in every newspaper, the press officer has rung around telling everybody to get everybody on their feet. And I've done it myself.
I did think the briefing in the Sunday Times piece is incredibly detailed. Yeah, it's almost like Colonel Mustard in the kitchen with the candlestick. It's so like the chief whip in the cloakroom overhearing conversations, you know.
Amidst the coats.
We're
in endgame. And we don't know how it's going. But one thing is not going very, very well. And anybody who can tell me what's going to happen next week, I don't believe them. Because it's so uncertain. And, you know, the idea of a group of very hard Remainers who wouldn't be representative of the Conservative Party, grouping up with a group of hard Remainers in the Labour Party, running the Parliament.
Is that not, in some ways, a good idea?
Well, I believe that we should actually facilitate Brexit, because I think it was a democratic decision. And the Irish government, and we've been using the backstop as a way of thwarting Brexit in some ways like that. And I think we should have tried to make Brexit as easy as possible. And if they wanted to have second thoughts, let's implement the first democratic decision. In the Good Friday Agreement, we looked at the whole issue of a unity referendum, but we made a clause in it that there could be no second referendum for at least 7 years. And I believe that's a very good idea in referenda, to put that in, to say you're making a decision. If you go back, you would tear Britain apart. You saw what happened to Joe Cox. You saw what happened to Anna Soubry. You see what happens to Jacob Rees-Mogg. The atmosphere is horrific over there. Right. We need to cool it.
Mary? Well, I thought the Shipman article was a very good article, and given the book that he has written, which is the definitive history of the whole Brexit campaign, I think he's a very authoritative source. But I don't think the problem is the Irish negotiating tactics. I think it's the problem is the lack of British negotiating tactics and skills. That is the real problem that is faced now. And it's very clear that Theresa May can't get a majority for almost anything. Personally, I think it's interesting the idea that there is a cross-party group trying to find where a consensus might be for some variation, I presume,
yes,
on the Theresa May deal.
Yeah.
But to somehow think that Ireland is the problem is to really...
Well, they articulate that point of view.
Brexit is the problem. And remember, we're only talking about the withdrawal agreement. If we agreed either to withdraw the backstop or put a time limit on it, we'd move into the transition period, which gives us 2 more years to wear. I don't think anybody's ready for a no-deal Brexit. And I think if we stand on ceremony over the backstop, we get nothing.
But I think you have to bear in mind why the backstop is there. If you cast your mind back to 2017, is probably the real key period, yeah, when... they were coming towards the December agreement that initially contained the backstop. The fear in Dublin was that the British would try to do almost what's being done to them now, to us. That if you remember, the talk at the time was the border will be sorted out in a future trading relationship. Don't worry, that'll all be done when we sit down and negotiate a trade deal. And the fear in Dublin was the British would use the border as a ramrod to get what they wanted in those trade agreements. And bear in mind to the language that was being used back then, like, I forget the amount of times we sat and listened to Theresa May saying we want the border to be as frictionless as possible. And those keywords were the ones that set off alarm in Dublin. So you can understand why it's there. Now, there is, I think there's a point about the manner in which there's a certain smugness, there's a certain triumphalism with how this has been conducted. Like, one episode sticks out to me was during a European Council meeting during the recent football tournament in the summer. The Taoiseach, he was supporting Belgium, we were playing England that night. Like, do you really need to say those things?
Yeah.
But on the substantive issue of the principle of the backstop, this arose because, correctly, the government, I think, viewed that the British were going to use the border as a ploy to get what they wanted, and they need to guard against
as
that.
As a bargaining chip.
I remember the first time we reported on the backstop, it wasn't called the backstop at the time, it was this idea floating around. The person who said to me was, we do not want the border being used as a gun in the next phase of the talks, which is to trade deal against us. And that is the reason for it. And yes, it's been weaponised, and yes, it's become the main stumbling block to a deal. But the border,
but
in some way, was always going to be that.
Yeah, but isn't there a point that, okay, we have our history and we don't want violence and, borders can be red rags to a bull. But long term, the European Union is not going to allow a sieve on the border on Ireland, and whether we like it or not, even if we didn't want to, which we probably don't, they're going to insist that it is policed.
Well, I don't know whether they are or they are not, but what I would say is that the EU has been working with incredible flexibility, despite what the British media says, to try to secure an interest that is an outcome that's in everybody's interest. It's not in anybody's interest to have a no-deal Brexit. That is very clear. It's not in German manufacturers' interests. It's not in French importers' interests. It's not in Ireland's interest. But the problem has been all along, and we shouldn't beat ourselves up about this, the problem has been that Britain has not properly articulated its objectives in a negotiation. How can you negotiate with someone who doesn't know what they can deliver?
Well, they know what they don't want. They don't want the backstop. And
but
at
we
the
don't
moment,
know what they
the
do
backstop,
want,
we don't
Ray.
Well,
they
want, we don't know that yet. There is an outside chance that this will fail this week. I think that's widely accepted. But
an outside chance that this will fail?
But no, sorry. There's an outside chance that it will eventually succeed. That it will fail this week, but it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that this goes back again and again and again. And the problem is that there's a majority in the Commons now against no deal, but there's no majority for anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah,
you could envisage a situation where the clock ticks down. That's Theresa May's strategy, it seems, to look people in the eye as the ball drops and say, what are we going to do?
But if there is a majority in the Commons for a soft Brexit, what is to stop, as we see from this piece today, cross-party MPs saying we would like a softer version of Brexit and stitching that into the political declaration, which is a looser document accompanying the withdrawal agreement, and saying this is where we want to go post-Brexit. That negates the need for the backstop. Mm. So it is causing untold difficulties in the House of Commons, but being blunt about it, it shouldn't be a concern to Dublin what happens in the Tory party. That is not Dublin's concern.
It should, actually, because the Tory party is the natural party of government.
It has to be a concern.
And we are now on a course which is very antagonistic to the bulk of the party membership. Remember, the Tory party in the Commons is not representative of them on the ground. The Tory party is going to become much more Brexit, pro-Brexit. Anyone joining it at the moment, the people like Anna Soubry and those, may not even be selected for the next election. It is not in our interest to get have a very antagonistic attitude.
That Tory party you speak about is the David Davis, Boris Johnson, let's let technology sort it out view of the
Tory
party.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of truth.
Shouldn't we look at it?
Well, there is an option to look at it in the withdrawal agreement.
Sorry, weren't the British asked to bring forward proposals that would show that it was viable? And aren't we still waiting after 2.5 years to see what those proposals are?
Yeah, and I think, you know, just as people are talking about the Conservative Party, the truth is Susan O'Keefe has a good piece on the Brexit battle, where she's, the headline is Corbyn drops the ball again. The truth is that, there is a failure. There is no real opposition here. There is no gathering. There is no sense that even if, she loses the vote on Tuesday and a general election comes about, the British public are not interested in having Jeremy Corbyn as their new Prime Minister.
Well, that'll be for them to say,
but all of the polls and all of the senses are that he has not shown the kind of leadership to actually give a clear sense of, here's the alternative, here's the steps towards it, back me and this is where we go. We have no idea.
Fergal?
I think what's clear is that the British voted to get out of the EU. They didn't actually vote for what it was that they wanted to get into.
Yes. Mm.
And they voted for all kinds of reasons. And ironically, the places with the greatest Brexit votes are probably likely to suffer most. The north of England and the working class areas. Which is ironic, and they're not Tory voting at all. But I think the fact that they don't have any idea what they actually wanted, I think, is the problem. Now, I think we did sell the backstop too triumphantly. We kind of went round Europe, pontificating about that this was a victory. I mean, this is a situation where
we were courting people, I think.
But when it happened, we gave the impression it was a victory. And what we've done is we've managed to get the Brexiteer Tories to unite, even the ones that are probably were more ambivalent, unite around this hated, odious. They're the terms that have been used in the papers to describe the Brexit, the backstop arrangement. Mm. And that is our problem, is that we've now given them something to unite around.
But amidst the drama before Christmas, when the vote was postponed, that week when you had the confidence mode, and Theresa Villiers, the former Northern Ireland Secretary, was on one of the British channels saying, it wasn't about the backstop anymore, but it was about the 39 billion now, and it was about the European Court of Justice. So you get the feeling if it wasn't for the backstop, it would be something else. It just happens.
But everybody in the... There's only 7 MPs in Westminster who support the backstop, and that's the Sinn Féin. Nobody else supports the backstop. Jeremy Corbyn doesn't support the backstop. The Labour Party does. The Lib Dems. Well, so you've got to realise that this is not going to run.
That means that 7 MPs are only going to vote for the withdrawal agreement on Tuesday evening.
Well, they're not going to vote because they attend the office but don't actually go into the Parliament. There's nobody there who supports the backstop. The Scottish...
The Cabinet do.
Yeah, they don't, because they said they want it for themselves, and if they vote for the North, then they're going to...
But that's the point, is that the point
Mary,
is...
I think Fiacre's point is that Theresa May may lose by, and sorry for putting the words into your mouth, 100 votes or 200 votes, but she's not going to lose by 600 votes plus. So there will be people voting for her. To me, the absolutely chilling thing is a sentence in the editorial in the Sunday Times, and it says, a defeat by closer to 100 votes or less would give Mrs. May hope. Mm. That is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. To be defeated by almost 100 votes, and that is your best hope of going forward.
Yeah, but the battles and wars, it's not the battle that matters, it's the long term that matters. And the long term, our interests lie in very good relations with our neighbours.
Absolutely, and it is absolutely heartbreaking to see what has happened there. It is heartbreaking to see how they have, first of all, triggered Article 50 before they needed to. Secondly, how they entered negotiations by keeping on excluding options. They should have kept all their options open for as long as they could keep them open. Thirdly, calling an election that meant that she lost her majority. At every step where there has been a fork in the road, they have taken the wrong
should
road.
Should we not be generous?
Of course, but I think we are generous. And when I say we, I think the European Union is generous. It isn't like people are jumping up and down all around Europe saying, oh, this is a great withdrawal treaty. It will cause difficulties for others. And for that reason, that is why the Brits should be fairly clear that they will get a good deal in the subsequent negotiations. And that is very clear. Nobody wants that to be the final outcome, if you like, of the relationship. Mm. So the idea that this is all win on one side and all loss on the UK side is simply, it's not sustainable.
Yeah, I see Bertie Ahern saying today in the paper that he is hoping that they will put it off into the future, so to speak, where he says UK must postpone Brexit. Do you see that as a runner?
I see that John Major has an interesting article online in today's Sunday Times as well edition, in which he's proposing something very similar, that there would be a decision endorsed by a vote in Parliament to seek a deferral of the an extension of Article 50, then the beginning of a consultative process, and then perhaps a second referendum, which would be obligatory this time. The last one was meant to be consultative, yeah, but which make clear what the future relationship would be. Now, I don't think that's going to fly, but the fact that there are a number of people of goodwill thinking in those terms, I think, is good.
Fergal?
There's an interesting straw in the wind this week. John Bercow, who's the Speaker of the House of Commons, is deemed to have deviated very significantly from the traditional way that Parliament does
precedent.
Its business.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's an expectation, and certainly it's alluded to in the Sunday Times page one article, where they're suggesting that the current model is that ministerial business always takes precedent over backbenchers' business, but there's an expectation that this will be overturned during the week, which will allow the type of kind of blue sky thinking which hasn't been present up to now to supervene. So it may be possible for arrangements to take place which are not either the typical black and white that the May government is trying to push through. So I think there are moves. I mean, what there isn't is a clear majority for anything in the House of Commons apart from not what we're getting.
More or less.
Yeah.
Ray?
Yeah, I think that an awful lot of people in Ireland can describe the problems, but they rarely bring forward a solution. I honestly think that the best way for us is now to say that we would put a time limit on the backstop and get through to the withdrawal, because we've said it's going to be temporary. Mm-hmm. It's not to be used. So why not put that down? That may help Theresa May get across. I think I spent some time in Westminster of speaking to people. I think people there are desperate for something they can actually support. I think this could be a face-saving device if Ireland, as a favour to our next-door neighbour, said, if this helps, we're going to put a time limit on the backstop. And the alternative is that we go for the default no deal. I mean, I don't see what we've got to lose on this.
On the no deal?
On putting a stop, withdrawing the backstop, or putting a time limit. If we believe it's temporary, let's call it temporary. Mm-hmm. That'll assuage an awful lot of the fears of the Tory backbenchers, and it may even get the DUP on board.
Yeah, one of the difficulties about doing this assuaging is that, you know, it is really what got us into this mess in the first instance, you know, with Cameron trying to, you know, assuage his backbenchers, with Theresa May doing the same. Even after the last vote, who did she speak to? She didn't speak to the people who voted for her. She was again trying to persuade the smaller groups who, I think, nothing is going to please them. So there is something, I accept there is something in being able to offer some thing that will shift the logjam without giving up. My real concern, and it's coming in many of the papers today, is how little prepared we seem to be And the idea that we are keeping the head in the sand and thinking, Ash, it'll be grand, we don't have to worry about it, it won't happen. We really need to be prepared
You and Fianna Fáil, as quoted in the Business Post, to a certain extent isn't the government's stymied, you know? If you prepare for something
you accept that.
Yeah, I think there was a document produced before Christmas on contingency planning for no deal, and it was pretty thin. There wasn't much detail in it, and we were told that more would come after Christmas. And the papers, I think, covered today, the Business Post, the Mail and the Sunday Indo, the Cabinet next week will see two detailed memos coming from the Minister for Health and the Minister for Transport about detailed no deal planning. Now, I think it's at that point we'll really be able to assess if they are really preparing for no deal or if it's all window dressing, because this is the detail we are promised. And there's this talk now in the papers of omnibus legislation clearing the decks in the Oireachtas in March and getting all the legislation needed through if we are at that phase. But if the government are to make people believe that they are adequately preparing for no deal, I think we need to see a bit more from them in the weeks ahead. It's expected that every cabinet will approve two or three plans from ministers about no deal planning. We haven't seen much heretofore. We would have to see it for the next few weeks on.
Okay, sir, you wanted to come in there first.
Well, just Tanner Bryan's article in the Sunday Independent is a concern, because he talks about our level of self-sufficiency and we're one of the least self-sufficient in Europe. Even in we see ourselves as an agricultural country.
Yeah.
We import 25 times more potatoes than we export.
Which is extraordinary.
Which is ironic in view of our history. We don't want to go there again. But also in terms of energy, we import most of our energy. So we have a serious problem. It'll hit us hardest. So we need, I don't have a difficulty with what Ray is proposing. If we genuinely think this is temporary, why not offer it? Now, we need to tie it up in such a way that it can't be used against us, but why not?
Mary?
Just 2 points on the point you just made there. First of all, we can't offer anything. We're part of an EU negotiation. Hold on a second, Marion. We've done extremely well. Let us not try and go off on our own now and then turn around in a year or two's time and look for EU solidarity if we try that game. And the second point is there is largely agreement across all parties on the Dáil on the elements that we want to see in a withdrawal treaty. And I don't think the government can tear that up without severe political repercussions in Ireland. It's simply inconceivable. So let's get real about this. Slogans won't work. The only thing that will work is the British Parliament to find some collective wisdom. And that is what the impediment to a proper exit is. On the question of preparations, obviously things are beginning to look pretty bad and we have to ramp up our preparations. But the trouble, and I think this is true across Europe for other countries that are badly affected, it's going to cost a lot of money that we all hope will be a waste of money. But that's effectively the dilemma, isn't it?
Right. And of course, that's banned in Britain now too after the vote in the Commons last week. We'll leave it there for the moment because we will be talking to somebody else later on in the programme. Caller was on to say we need a new EU-based... We need a new EU based on equality, not profit, and one that does not lurch from one crisis to another. That comes from Tralee. Another one, Brexit is a British decision. The EU are bending over backwards to facilitate Britain. The British do not understand the nature of the EU. They've been in it for the same length of time that we have. Learn from history. The British did not honour the Boundary Commission in the 1920s. Oh, God, don't you hate God?
Untrue, but it doesn't matter. Okay. Good idea.
We've years of this ahead of us. Anyway, on that note, we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme, and we're going to move on now to the subject of health, and there's a variety of areas covered in it. And as I said before, when in 1 week the price of the Children's Hospital had gone from, I think it was about 900 million, and then it was 1.4 billion. Sorry, I'm getting my millions and billions mixed up. So just to cheer you all up, it is now mentioned at 1.7 billion today. This is like a runaway horse. It really and truly is. But anyway, that and others about what's going to happen with drugs in terms of Brexit, I mean medical drugs here, and of course the nursing strike. Let me go to you first. This is your area, Fergal.
Yeah, I think the National Children's Hospital, I think most medical people at this stage just want to get the damn thing finished. But the irony, of course, is that the government set up a board with project management experience to manage this project. This wasn't managed by the HSC in the traditional sense. And yet it's gone from 600 million to...
It started out at 450 million.
Yeah, I mean, what's a few hundred million nowadays seems to be the mentality.
Yeah.
The problem, of course, is that there is no capital investment elsewhere in the healthcare system at the moment. So necessary
it's
capital...
It's soaking it all in.
Everything. And potentially for many years to come. So necessary projects are not taking place. And of course, what we know is that we're chronically short of acute hospital beds. We're not going to get those. They've all been sacrificed on the altar at the National Children's Hospital. But we're partway through a process. We need to have a National Children's Hospital because, I mean, certainly the infrastructure, particularly in Temple Street, isn't fit for purpose, as anyone will know that's been there. It's three Georgian houses stuck together.
Yeah.
So we do need to move on this. I mean, obviously, the other big issue coming down the tracks is the nurses dispute. And Susan Mitchell, as ever, has a very, very good analysis of the situation.
Yeah, could you go through what she was saying in her article today? This is in the Business Post.
So, and I think one of the challenges here is that what is representing nurses are essentially two trade unions. There's the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, which is a trade union. It's not a professional body in the sense that you might have a Royal College or an Irish College of Nursing, and you SIPTU. And this has been managed as an industrial relations problem. And many of their contentions have been, and Susan certainly, her analysis would say they're dubious. So she says that we are overprovided for nurses by EU standards.
Yeah, that was extraordinary.
And she bases that on, you know, factual evidence. The reality is, and certainly in my experience and in my department, we are anything but
overstaffed
with nurses.
Yeah.
And in fact, what has certainly been our experience in the last couple of years is new nurses that have taken up posts, many of them have left the job within a few months. So there is a retention problem, there is a recruitment problem. It's particularly acute in those sectors of the hospital service which are under the greatest pressure. But we're not short of nurses countrywide.
So is it just that they're not being assigned?
So I think there is an issue of skill mix here. And partly because this has become, you know, I haven't seen from the Department of Health or the HSE any strategic documents about the future of nursing. So it seems to be that any time there's an industrial dispute, there seems to be some process that comes out of that which produces more and more promotional jobs for nurses without dealing with the underlying structural issues. So if you look at our neighbours in the NHS, the NHS would have many grades below the level of a staff nurse the people in those grades do much of the work that's currently done by staff nurses, such as taking blood, doing ECGs, a lot of what might have been described as the work done by student nurses and probationer nurses in older times. So I think what we have is we have a large number of nurses, but we have fewer grades below that. So our skill mix proportionately is wrong.
Right.
Now, I don't see the government giving in to a demand for 12% because of all the relativities with other healthcare professionals in the system. And you can see in the coverage today that one of the issues identified, and it's identified by Susan Mitchell and others, is that there's a lot of dispute between nurses and other grades of healthcare professional staff.
Yeah.
And this is coming to the fore. And unfortunately, I think this is going to be a very bitter dispute.
Right.
And I don't think the nurses will win it.
Well, the other thing I forgot to mention was on the front page of the same Business Post and written by the same woman. She tells us that they are going to change the structures. Structural changes to the health service are at an advanced stage. And they're going to divide everything up, it would appear, between five and six regional integrated care organisations, known as RICOs, established across Ireland. In 2013, Fine Gael said the creation of hospital groups represented the most fundamental reform of the Irish acute hospital system in decades. Delighted with themselves on that. That was under James Riley. And now we have Minister Harris recently saying it's not fit for purpose. If you worked in the health service, you'd be banging your head off the wall.
Well, many people do bang their head off the wall, and that doesn't do them much good in the long term.
Changing.
Yes. So I think what's fair to say is that hospital groups of themselves were not a bad creation. However,
Should we not give them a try?
But some of them, certainly east of the Shannon, don't make sense. So if you look at a map of basically the province of Leinster and the province of Munster, the hospital group boundaries there actually don't make sense, particularly east of the Shannon. I mean, I'm in the Saoltach group, which basically stretches from Donegal to Galway. It's the old Western and Northwestern health boards.
Yeah.
But then the community health organisations, which are responsible for community care, those boundaries are not coterminous. So we have two CHO areas. So in our particular case, we have Cavan and Monaghan involved. Now, they have no connection whatsoever with the Saoltach group. So that makes no sense. So the boundaries were created by people, and arguably maybe they were created to create jobs and additional layers of bureaucrats, but they certainly are not fit for purpose. I think what is being proposed now is likely to be fewer groups who are responsible for both the hospitals and the community. We're in many ways going back to the health boards without the same level of political interference. However, there'll be fewer of them. And to be honest, although we're going, appear to be going backwards, that probably is progress.
Grainne?
Yeah, I mean, I think that idea of what's called population-based planning is a sensible way to go forward. And it was one of the key strengths, I think, of the Sláintecare Care report. This idea.
You're involved.
I'm involved. I'm doing a bit of work with them around a public engagement strategy for the Sláintecare project. And I think there's something about, you know, going back and using, it looks like, oh no, you know, here's another plan. And I'm sure the people bang on their heads, that's exactly what they're saying. But the truth is that for the patients and also for the staff, I think there is something about using population-based planning to give you a reason for why you have centres of excellence, proper hospitals, proper and community-based services. So if it can be delivered, it will be transformational. The trick will be delivering it in the 10-year period.
And the levels of changes in management that will happen.
All of that. But just to go back for a moment to the nursing strike.
Oh, surely, yeah.
Because I think Willie Keeley's piece in The Independent is succinct. And he mentions, as you do, Fergal, the issue of that relativity is a major reason why it looks like the nurses may not win this. So I think he starts off indeed with his saying, nurses are fantastic. So I think all around the country, any of us who've ever had to deal with a mammy or a child or ourselves in a hospital, the nurses are gold and they deserve. Part of it is the spin at the moment about pay rises. A lot of what they're looking for is pay restoration. So I think that from a fairness point of view, there is a point of money lost and also that their wages are not terribly high. But we're in a situation where
They make up, I didn't realise, 32% of all the staff in health.
That's right. Yeah. So it's huge, huge proportion. Yeah. So the cost of that obviously is problematic. But I think it's really about the government wanting to hold the public service agreement. And it was quite clear about what they think. So they're suggesting, and other commissions indeed, that there needs to be a whole root and branch look at nursing, the structures you're talking about, new levels of responsibility and pay associated with those. So a 12% is not going to solve that problem either. No. So there is something about, will the government hold fast on this because they don't want the tumble down dominoes?
Yeah. Well, the other thing about it is when the training of nurses changed
to degrees,
From a kind of an apprenticeship, really, which I've heard a lot of people, including nurses, saying within the system that actually it didn't improve things at all. But it does mean that you have degree status. So you're looking at somebody else who has a degree and saying, I want parity with that field.
The occupation,
how do you look at it?
the comparisons made in Susan's piece to occupational therapists and physiotherapists, yes, nurses saying, well, we have degrees, they have degrees, we should be on a similar standard to them. But I think what previous people have said is correct, that it looks like the government are going to try and hold the line on this, and it looks that it's going to be a pretty vicious dispute. Like, I think Willie Keeley's piece captures it quite well, in that there can't be a worse enemy, if I can put it that way, for the government than the nurses. Yeah. Everybody has a really, really high quality experience of nursing staff in hospitals. Myself being in hospitals, you know, my wife had a baby last year, was midwife led. We didn't go near a doctor at all. It was superb. And you can't speak kindly from them. But I think there's a perfect storm now, and you've referenced it with the children's hospital. You have a situation where the children's hospital's budget is running out of control.
Completely.
You have the government's budgetary strategy just before Christmas lacerated by the Fiscal Advisory Council. And you now just wonder, are the government sensitive to claims that they could be going back to the Celtic Tiger era of letting spending off the leash completely? And it's at this point that the nurses have decided to take them on. And you just wonder, is the resolve, the government's resolve, a bit harder for the issues of the knock-on effects it would have across the public service? Yeah. Remember what happened to the guards? They got 50 million, but it cost more in the long run.
And the lack of unity amongst the unions. There isn't a unity of purpose amongst the nursing trade unions. They're split.
Yeah, but there seems to be unity of purpose among the nurses who voted.
Yes.
I mean, there was great
huge
unity.
About,
you want to come in, Mary?
Yeah, just...
You've lived in a number of countries.
Yes.
So you would have experienced, and I'll ask you about it, Ray, as well, of different systems.
Yes, yeah, and there's some better and there's some worse, surprisingly. I know what I find frustrating about ours is just no matter how much money we put in, it doesn't seem to get better. That's what I find frustrating, and that's not a reflection on the people in the system. We all have great stories about the people in the system. But what I think when I think about the imminent nurses' strike is the one group that can't go on strike are the patients. Mm-hmm. And I am really tired of patients being taken hostage by whatever interest group. And that really is to me the problem here. You know, it's relativity with this, with relativity with that. But what about the relativity of outcomes of the people who go through the system? And that is, doesn't get half enough focus.
The other elephant in the room with this is the front page of the Sunday Inn, no living costs now at Celtic Tiger levels. If the problem is so acute in Dublin, nurses' income can't meet the income level of renting or buying a home. And you would imagine that's a huge difficulty. The housing crisis in particular is probably the issue that nurses who want to live and work in Dublin find it prohibitive to get accommodation around the capital, and they can't afford to stay here, and that's why they're going away.
And I recall on this programme one of your colleagues, Michael O'Keefe, talking about the fact that the nurses had to pay €15 a day for parking. You'd imagine that's not a lot to expect if you've driven in from Leash or wherever.
That's difficult. That's where they're driving in from.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Willie Keeley's piece is probably... encapsulates things very well. I mean, nurses are crucial to the healthcare system. They do a really good job. I think the decision-making about where they're going doesn't make sense to me. I think the leadership that is bringing them down this path doesn't seem to appreciate that the lack of leverage that they have. There's probably going to be 800 people on trolleys at that time.
God.
And that's the reality of this. We can expect that number to rise. Influenza has kicked off, and kicked off in a big way. So the background level of influenza currently is twice the normal level. We've had a meningitis outbreak. So I think nurses are going to be putting in an invidious position. I also think that the speed at which they intend to ramp this up, so they're having a one-day strike at the end of January, then the following week they're having a two-day strike, followed by a three-day strike. I think a number of nurses will say, I can't do this.
Count
me out. I can't go there.
Yeah.
And I think that's an invidious position to be put in for a fight that they may not win. I suspect that they won't.
Okay, can I come back to you, Ray, on other systems? Because your last posting was in Canada, and you hear wondrous praise for Canada, but then if you know a few Canadians, you hear a few moans too. How would you describe it?
I describe it as a good system, but it's good and it has its good points and it has its bad points. I actually started life as a biochemist in the Mater Hospital, so in the health system, so I have a great deal of sympathy for the nurses. In the Canadian system, and I think Fergal has touched on it, there seems to be much greater support for nurses. We seem to, you know, the idea, same with teachers here, you hire 2,000 new teachers. And then you say, we've got a great number of teachers. But the fact that you don't have the teaching assistants, you don't have the nurse should be at the kind of, I wouldn't say the apex of that kind of nursing area. And if you don't bring in apprentices and nurses, you have to have nursing aid. And we seem to, as I say, go for the headline figure, go for the, we've got so many nurses, but it doesn't really tell you the story and on the ground, the hospital, because there's clearly a huge amount of dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
And that has to be tackled. How it's tackled, I'm no expert on it, but if nurses are feeling alienated, something has got to be done to try and alleviate the situation.
Okay, another caller was on to say, I worked as a qualified nurse for 17 years in an acute hospital. I have 2 degrees and a master's paid for by myself. After all the stress, etc., I come out with 43,000 a year. Had enough. I can't buy a house in Dublin. I've left nursing. People say nurses are great, but they show absolutely no respect for us.
It's interesting, the Public Sector Pay Commission, you know, which was not hugely supportive in its recommendations, but it does acknowledge that the basic salary for nurses is lower than comparators, but their overtime rates are higher. And again, when you have overtime rates that are disproportionately high, that suggests a whole kind of trade union-driven process. I think we need to fundamentally look at how nursing is delivered. The so-called Commission on Nursing of a number of years ago arose from an industrial dispute, but it seems to have produced lots of promotional grades without dealing with the fundamental issues.
Right. Okay, more in on that. A public servant, a taxpayer, I think this strike is a disgrace. We have a public pay agreement and the nurses signed up to it. They're not striking for just more nurses, where I would be sympathetic, but for more money for themselves. Government also contributed to this by giving in to the Gardaí, and that comes from Gary. Now, I want to move on quickly, if I may, to the Abbey. And another area of dissatisfaction, it would appear. And there's a lot, well, there's a fair amount of coverage today. Why does the, in the Sunday Independent, why does the Abbey only receive attention in the eye of a crisis? And another one, Irish players exit stage left in the Abbey Theatre's self-inflicted wounds in the Business Post. Start with you, Grainne.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a story that started off quietly and has really taken wheels. Indeed, you know, your own coverage talking yesterday to individuals who signed the letter. I mean, there does seem to be an issue about, you know, is there a conflict between getting the bums on seats to make sure you're turning over profit to be able to pay salary and all of that, and at the same time, the role, the cultural role of the National Theatre, you know. And I think there is a huge attachment to that going back to Yeats and all those years back. So the idea of the notion that there's something about Irish actors and other stage professionals being unable to get work in the National Theatre has really touched a nerve and needs to be looked at. The initial response, I think, was quite poor by the management there and indeed by the board. So I think maybe there's been a bit of a wake-up call towards the end of the week. But certainly, I think there is. And indeed, it's not the first wake-up call. I mean, the recent issue about the position of women in theatre and the lack of plays being produced at the National Theatre by women. And I think that has been sorted. And this is now another crisis that they've moved into.
Ray?
I agree completely. I mean, the Abbey is an iconic part of our almost identity as Irish people. The amount of money is tiny in terms of the subsidy, even relative to other places. I think there's obviously a confusion of roles. What were the direction given to the two people who went in, and
yes,
maybe carrying out the role completely? But I think, you know, we have a small theatre industry here, and you know, you can't maintain acting standards and that on the basis on which it has been happening in the Abbey at the moment. I think there needs to be a change in policy, and I would have a lot of sympathy with the people who wrote in.
Okay, Mary?
Well, I think the Abbey is a world-class cultural institution, and I think we should treasure it a lot more. I was really shocked to find out that some of the actors were being paid less when they were appearing in co-productions such as the Richard III, which was superb, as distinct from when they're appearing as Abbey players. I I found that extraordinary.
I found that extraordinary too. But I found just, it extraordinary that the Equity hadn't done anything about it. But anyway, that's...
But, you know, as somebody who was at that performance, I thought it was wonderful. I would have felt really quite guilty knowing that they were being paid so badly had I known it at the time. And I really think that the amount of money, as Ray said, it's peanuts. And we should pay our actors properly.
Well, if you were... So the Abbey gets nearly 7 million. Mm-hmm. There are theatre groups right around the country that would love a few of those crumbs, and they wouldn't regard them as peanuts. They'd really like to have them. And presumably the reason they can't pay the same rate, and I'm not talking about Druid, is they haven't got the money.
Yeah, but the Abbey also has another role where it brings money into the economy. It's very normal for American tourists or European tourists to include a trip to the Abbey on their must-do things.
Yes.
Our pricing is very low. That's great, but we almost give away the tickets when you compare it to similar theatres overseas. And so we're not measuring how much money tourism, right, including an Abbey dimension, are bringing in.
Okay, Fair.
I was surprised this week at how badly it was in handle initially. That statement that claimed there was a 1.4 million deficit, which was then proven to be false, just completely inflamed the situation needlessly and, you know, kind of cast aspersions on the performance of the previous director, Fiacc MacNeill. But I think Brendan O'Connor makes an interesting point in his article. It's a very good piece kind of outlining, you know, the people who work in the artist community, it isn't a very lucrative business. They're often going from job to job.
85% unemployment among our acting. I was astounded.
At 850 to 950 a week, of which out of the 52 weeks of the year, you might only work 20 or 30 of them.
And the runs are being shortened by this process.
That was also part of their remit to have diversity and to use the smaller companies.
In O'Connor's piece, he cites this previous idea flow by Angus McInerney that you would have almost two entities within the one organisation. One would be a commercial arm that would subsidise the serious arm, if you will. And would there not be validity to that? You often hear people who run Michelin star restaurants, they have subsidises the Michelin restaurant. So perhaps maybe it is.
And we have to think money here now too, and I have to take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
And thank you very, very much indeed. Now, as we have been hearing, the British Prime Minister Theresa May has warned that it would be catastrophic and unforgivable breach of trust in democracy if Brexit doesn't go ahead. Well, joining me on the line now is a staunch supporter of Brexit. He's Mark Reckless, a former Conservative and UKIP MP, and now an Assembly member for South Wales, and in a couple of minutes I'll also be talking to Enda Brady, Sky News correspondent. Now, let me go to you first, Mark. Give us a hint at your own background and being with UKIP and which party and all of that.
Well, I mean, I sort of came into to politics because I believe we should be a sovereign, independent country taking our own decisions rather than paying 27 other countries to make our laws for us. So that's what I've sought to do through my political career. I was three times a Conservative candidate and was finally elected in 2010, so that's the seat of Rochester in And then in order to help ensure we had and then won a referendum, I left the Conservatives and joined UKIP and was one of two MPs to win a seat for UKIP in a by-election in my case. Since then, when Theresa May triggered Article 15 and English, we're going to leave the European Union and leave its customs union, its single market, I joined the Conservative group in the Welsh Assembly, where I currently take the Conservative whip.
In the Welsh Assembly?
That's right.
Yeah. When you say make decisions for ourselves, I know that right across Europe people are critical of the European structures from time to time, and the Commission in particular. But nonetheless, all are involved in the final decision-making, including Britain and including Ireland. It's not as though 27 people are giving you instructions, or 27 countries, I should say, because you're part of the decision-making process.
The European Union was set up by Jean Monnet and other founders in order to drive the creation of a single European state. And knowing that isn't something that would be supported democracies of Europe, they have sort of hidden their agenda, but had structures, including the European Court of Justice, which interprets laws in order to promote European integration, and the European Commission, which is unelected and is the only body that can propose a law in the European Union, which are, to our mind, sort of fundamentally undemocratic. And we in the United Kingdom would like to govern ourselves, and we've made that choice in a referendum, and I think people are growing increasingly angry at those who would try and frustrate that sovereign decision.
People are talking about soft Brexit, hard Brexit, crash out Brexit. Which would be your chosen one?
Well, I would like a sensible deal, and one where we continue to enjoy free trade and remain sort of cooperating with the European Union in a sensible way that would be in all our interests. Unfortunately, that is being put at risk largely by the policies of Leo Varadkar and Simon Copeland. And this.
Why do you put it at their door in particular?
Well, because when I led a committee of the Welsh Assembly in December 2016, we visited Doyle, we met with Taoiseach Enda Kenny. You know, I think there was a very sensible approach going on, and there was a lot of cooperation at an official and indeed political level between Britain and Ireland to ensure that we could sort of manage the border and continue to have close cooperation after we left the EU. Unfortunately, once Leo Varadkar took over, that policy changed. Those meetings stopped. The cooperation we were seeing at an official level was no more. And we've had this demand from Ireland and the European Union that we should only be allowed to leave the EU if we agree to a backstop in which the whole of the UK can be held in a customs union against its will, where the EU negotiates access to our market without having to offer us access to third countries in exchange, and to have the Northern Ireland in a system where most of its laws are made by the European Union, to which it doesn't elect anyone or have any say. And somehow the unionists in Northern Ireland are meant to look to Dublin for sort of representation in the European Union, and those who make decisions against their will and without any democratic input. I mean, that is wrong, and we cannot as a country agree to that. So therefore, Parliament cannot back this deal, and there is an increasing chance we leave without a deal, whether the hardest of Brexits, which will be very difficult for Ireland as well as ourselves, but we will at least have a competitive currency which will assist UK producers, and we'll be able to cut tariffs so we no longer have to buy some overpriced goods from the European Union and can trade freely elsewhere in the world instead.
When you say trade freely, I have somebody in studio who's spent time, shall we say, engaging on WTO, and I'll come to you in a minute on that, Mary. How do you anticipate if we don't get a chance to negotiate what you described as a sensible deal, which we all hope will happen, but how would the WTO work as far as you're concerned?
Well, let me take an example. We basically would get control over our own tariffs, and we'll no longer have to apply many other significant tariffs to non-EU producers to protect European producers in the sector of beef. Most, I think, of Ireland's beef is exported, and mainly to the United Kingdom. And
that's
the
right.
reason for that is because we are forced to apply a tariff of close to 40% on any beef that we buy from overseas. So while in the past the UK would have bought beef from Argentina, from Australia, and they would have had great reputations for quality and strong markets, since our accession to the European Union, there have been massive tariffs to prevent that trade happening, so that our consumers made to buy beef from Ireland at a much higher price than they would have to if we were able to trade freely with the rest of the world.
Now, Mary Whelan on that. First of all, explain what your involvement in the WTO was.
Well, it goes back some years. From between 2001 and 2006, I was the Irish permanent representative to the World Trade Organization in Geneva. that is essentially what my involvement was.
So how do you anticipate this? If I mean, if we take the spirit of what Ray was saying, these are our next door neighbours. We should be best friends with our next door neighbours. They don't like the way the show is run. They've said goodbye. I want to go. But if we do a crash out, how would WTO kick in?
Well, Britain would be, if there's a crash out, Britain would be a third country from the 30th of March. And that would mean it would have to be treated as a third country that is not a member of the EU. The WTO works on the basis of most favoured nation. So if I offer you a 2% tariff, for example, I have to offer it to every other member, unless I'm in a free trade agreement arrangement, such as the EU would be. Now, the as I understand it, the UK government has submitted draft schedules to the WTO and they are trying to initially preserve the same tariff rates, or that's what the media are telling us, as they currently have as an EU member state. But that has to be negotiated with other members of the WTO. And what's proving difficult at the moment, again, if one is just following the specialist press, is one of the issues is agricultural imports. Because at the moment, it is possible to import beef from outside the European Union. Of course it is, and we're all aware that there is Brazilian beef on the market and so on, but that is coming in under quotas. Now that quota, the plan had been between the EU and the UK that that quota would be divided between the UK and the EU. But that arrangement, which the UK, Liam Fox has said this, he thought it would be very straightforward, that has to be negotiated with other member states of the World Trade Organization, and they may look for naturally concessions here, concessions there around that. So certainly it's possible to do it. Is it advantageous to do it? In some sectors it might be for the UK, in some sectors it might not be. The real problem, as I would see it, if I were a British trade official, what I would look at is the fact that the UK, it's really valuable exports, or many of its valuable exports, are in the services sector.
Yes.
And that's in a much different area than a simple tariff arrangement. And that will not be negotiated in the same way. The other point I would make would be...
How do you mean that will not be negotiated
because
in the same way?
Because the world trade rules for trade and services are not as developed as the world trade rules for trade
products
and goods. Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. So they will be subject to a whole series of bilaterals, multilaterals, regulatory...
Well, then wouldn't that give the British people more control?
Not necessarily. First of all, you have to start from the premise that Britain is leaving what is its largest free trade area with its largest trading partner. The EU takes something like 44% of UK exports. Now, you're actually coming out of an arrangement where you're trading freely there, and you're trying to negotiate arrangements with third countries. At the same time, you've put yourself into a disadvantageous position with your largest trading partner. This has never happened before.
Do you take that point on board, Mark?
Well, there's a range of points there. I think one of my problems with the European Union is in negotiating trade deals outside the EU is it hasn't sought strongly enough to open other markets to our services that we are particularly good at exporting. And if we're an independent country entering into our own trade deals, it will be open to us to open up access to our currently very protected agricultural market, and instead of buying food which is more expensive from the European Union, including Ireland, our consumers can get cheaper, but still in most cases high quality food from elsewhere. And because those countries are so keen to increase their agricultural exports, in return for our opening our agricultural market, importing food from elsewhere in the world, we should be able to agree to get those other countries to lower their barriers to our services exporters, which is a win-win for us.
Ray, how do you hear this?
What we all want is a good trade deal. And I just want to ask Mark, and hello, Mark, good to talk to you again. Ray Bassett.
Hello, Ray.
I just want to ask you, if the Irish government unilaterally made an offer to either withdraw the backstop or to put a time limit on it, What's your reading on how that would affect the vote in Westminster, given that we're only trying to get through the withdrawal part of it into the main negotiations? Do you think that that could be a significant move to break the logjam?
I think that could be the way forward, because I think if we were to go into the backstop, because we couldn't leave it through a sovereign decision and would need the EU's permission to get out of it, that basically would give the EU all the power in the negotiations. Whereas now we've triggered Article 50, if you know, comes to March the 29th and we leave without a deal, as a hard Brexit, and even if there's tariffs, we don't want that situation. But neither does the European Union, not least because it exports so much more to the UK than we export to the rest of the EU. And therefore, I think if we were to drop the backstop, we would have a much better chance of having an agreed transition and continued for free trade that would be of such great benefit to Ireland. And it's actually the insistence on the backstop which is counterproductive and self-defeating and potentially pushing Britain into a hard Brexit.
Are you saying to, like, categorically just say forget about a backstop at all, or put a time limit on it?
I mean, I think a time limit would be better than the current situation. We're already agreeing to a transition period of 21 months where essentially we'll remain members of the EU without a say, which is not a situation I like, but at least I know that it will come to an end and will sensibly give more time to negotiate trading relationships, which could keep open free trade going forward. That's something we all want. So, you know, in principle, if that was, you know, 2 years and 3 months rather than 21 months, as long as I knew it was coming to an end, I don't think that would be the deal stopper. And I'm not saying it's going to change the vote on Tuesday. I think we're too late for that. But I think if we are to see an agreed deal and to get that through before March the 29th, then I think part of that has to be Ireland understanding that this backstop is causing such problems that the British Parliament can't agree to it because its terms are so appalling for us and we can't allow other countries to prevent us being able to leave it. But actually, if we were to agree a cooperative arrangement, it's in all our interest to keep that free trade and not to have tariffs. So I think we would then be able to negotiate a deal that would be much better for Ireland and much better for the UK than one where we drop out without any negotiated arrangement at all.
Can I ask you two questions? And it really has to do with Wales and with Scotland.
Yes.
And in the whole of the referendum, Northern Ireland as a section of the UK voted to remain. Wales voted to leave. Scotland voted to remain. And if this backstop were adjusted or tweaked or whatever, how will that go down in Scotland and in Wales? Because presumably you would like the benefits that were offered to Northern Ireland that the DUP turned down.
Well, I don't think we see them as benefits. Wales voted to leave,
yes,
and we don't want to be forced to stay into the European single market with no say in the way the backstop would keep Northern Ireland. That's not something we want. In Scotland, Scotland voted to remain, but yeah, there was a very substantial leave vote nonetheless. And the SNP government in Scotland, who of course want to leave the European Union, I mean, they argue for wanting to stay in the European single market, albeit they have much more trade with England than they do with elsewhere. And I think part of the problem with the backstop is keeping Northern Ireland in the single market. The nationalists in Scotland who want to break up the UK, they say, oh, well, we want that situation too. But for us in Wales, it's not something we would welcome, firstly, because we voted to leave,
right,
and secondly, because if there is a regulatory boundary down the Irish Sea, then that causes us problems in terms of our trade with Northern Ireland as
right,
well as Ireland in
yeah,
terms of extra checks and difficulties at ports potentially.
Okay, listen, I just want to briefly join with Enda Brady also, who is the Sky News correspondent. Now, I hate asking people questions that requires a crystal ball, but I presume dependent on what happens on Tuesday, there's A, B, C, D, etc. could happen. I presume you read that story in the Sunday Times, the same as ourselves. They were discussing it on Sky Papers last night. What do you think will happen on Tuesday?
That's a very, very good question, Marion. The one thing that strikes me, you know, I think straight off, I think, you know, all the indications are everyone is agreed that the deal will not get through in its current format on Tuesday. Speak to whatever party, whatever colour of politics, whatever political journalist, everyone seems in agreement that it is highly, highly unlikely that Theresa May will get this deal through Parliament on Tuesday evening. Then what happens next? That, you know, asking people for predictions, several people I've spoken to over the last couple of days, extremely well-connected people in Westminster, and they've all got a different prediction. And the one prediction, really, the strongest voice I heard today, a very well-connected person said to me that Britain will eventually leave the European Union with a deal. And I said, well, what will the deal be? And that person said to me, well, that's what no one knows. It is extremely febrile times. Tuesday is huge for Theresa May, but certainly all the indications are that she's between 70 and 90 of her own MPs away from getting that deal through on Tuesday. And, you know, she's run out of time now.
What are the consequences of that?
Well, I think it's really interesting that the Sunday Times exclusive by Tim Shipman this morning saying that this cross-party group of backbench MPs are going to effectively try and hamstring the government so that Theresa May would be in government but unable to govern. I think we would see that ratcheted up perhaps on Wednesday. The immediate consequences are that if this deal does not get voted through on Tuesday evening, she now has 3 working days to come back to Parliament and put forward and reveal her plan B. Yeah,
Parliament won't sit on
Friday.
So it'll be Monday. But I noticed that Jeremy Corbyn was on the BBC this morning, and speaking to Andrew Marr, he said he will table a motion of no confidence in the government soon. He said Labour will, quote, see what happens, unquote, following Tuesday's critical vote on the Prime Minister's deal. And he went on to say, quote, we will table a motion of no confidence in the government at a time of our choosing, but it's going to be soon. Don't worry about it. He was repeatedly asked what Labour would campaign to leave the EU if a general election were called, and he sidestepped the question. So that's completely clear then.
Well, I think the interesting thing there is Corbyn has to get the timing right. And, you know, if you were asking me for a prediction, the deal does not get voted through on Tuesday. Theresa May is in another crisis. She will have people inside her own party jostling for position, future leaders wanting to step forward. And then I think you would see maybe Corbyn on Wednesday or Thursday. He may even wait until next Monday to see what plan B is. And if he doesn't like the look of plan B, at that point then trigger his motion of no confidence. But it's every single day this week will be compelling. Tuesday and the build-up to it will be fascinating. And I think by Tuesday evening, the likelihood is you'll see the deal fall and fail by at least 90 MPs, most of whom will be Conservatives. And then the divisions just keep coming, Marion. That is the really fascinating aspect of this.
Right.
We are in a really divided Britain right now. And, you know,
ways also to be nastily divided. I mean, people are perfectly entitled to have a different political point of view. But if you take what has happened in the United States, Trump supporters versus non-Trump supporters, there's a terrible division and bitterness there. And I gather that's developing in Britain now too.
Yes, it is. It is. And I've experienced this firsthand. I mean, if you stand out, if you are not from here, if you're a little bit different, suddenly a certain... And I have to say, it is a tiny percentage of society who suddenly feel empowered and emboldened and feel that they can go up to people and rant these kind of views at people about where Britain should be heading and who's at fault. It is quite extraordinary. Well, you know, I'd love to sit down and have a cup of tea with David Cameron and have him to honestly assess his decision to give that referendum in the first place.
What would you say, Mark?
Well, I mean, David Cameron took the decision to offer the referendum, at least as he told Angela Merkel, the week after I won a motion in Parliament, actually, the first time his government was defeated on the floor of the House, to cut the EU budget. And it was in response to that loss of control of Parliament and not having a majority that he decided it needed to be settled by the British people. It has been. We need to implement that result. And
so it's all your fault, really, Mark. Is that what you're saying to us?
Well, both as a Conservative backbench MP and then later when I was in UKIP, I've done everything I can to try and restore our country's independence and make us again a sovereign, self-governed country, taking our own decisions and trading freely with the whole world rather than having these big protectionist barriers. And I think that is the way forward for our country. And I think it's where we're going to go on an agreed and sensible basis rather than having this backstop lead to us sort of falling out without a deal at all.
Okay, before you go, what are your Irish connections?
Well, my mother is Irish. She grew up in Dunleary.
Yeah.
And her father, my grandfather, he was a Fianna Fáil TD for Donegal East. And I have sort of...
connections.
Many of the family are still in Ireland and others move to Australia and to England and to the United States.
Okay, well, listen, you find those connections everywhere you go.
Yeah, we'll see if any of them report back to my mother. Thank you very much for having me on.
Okay, Mark Reckless, thank you very much indeed. And Enda, to you also, thank you very, very much indeed. That is Enda Brady of Sky News fame. We'll take a break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Just looking at some of the calls that came in there. Just this is briefly referring back to what we were talking about earlier. Your panel are happy to see theatre actors get a decent level of pay, but not theatre nurses. I know which one I'd prefer to pay better if my life depended on it. So there you go. Consider yourselves chastised. Now, let's go to America. Where it is a case of a new day and a new controversy engulfing the US President Donald Trump. Marion McKeown is US correspondent for the Sunday Business Post and she joins us now. Marion, quite a lot to talk about. Let's start with the latest one. Trump as a Russian spy? Has the New York Times lost its marbles?
You know, there is this sense, Marion, of you couldn't make this stuff up. And I know we will get to a story about the current crisis with the shutdown, etc.
Yes.
later. But what these stories always make you ask first is, what are they obscuring? What are they distracting us from? And a lot of things are going on at the moment with the Mueller report and this report, which is not at all that surprising when you think about it. The report you're referring to was in the Washington Post and the New York Times, and it emerged that the FBI decided to investigate Donald Trump when he was president to see if he was a Russian asset and to see if he was working for the Russians. Now, this investigation was triggered back in early May 2017 after Trump had fired James Comey as the FBI director, and the following day he invited Sergei Kislyak, who was then the US ambassador to Russia, well known to be a spy master, and the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov into the Oval Office. He had a meeting with them. Nobody was invited except for the Russians, and he said to them, oh, you know, I got rid of that nut job, James Comey. He's talking about his own FBI director and said he was putting a lot of pressure on me over Russia, or I was under a lot of pressure, you know, because of him. So, of course, the Russians are delighted to leak this. It comes out from Russia, not from the Americans. And the FBI then director, Andrew McCabe, you know, says, okay, he's just fired the FBI director. He's telling a Russian spy that Comey was a nut job, and now he's not, you know, he relieves the pressure he was under by firing him. So you do have to ask yourself, what is going on with the President of the United States? So the FBI then started to investigate what MD had been suspicious about anyway at that stage, which was Donald Trump's connections to Russia and why he was behaving as he was behaving. Then, of course, Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel,
yep.
And he took over the whole thing then. And, of course, that $64 million question is still ongoing. And Robert Mueller, there are all kinds of nonsensical rumours at the moment going on about what Robert Mueller is doing, when he will finish, etc., etc. The truth is, nobody knows but Robert Mueller and his team. And in 18, 20 months now of their investigation, there hasn't been a single leak. So everything that
we're hearing
and reading is pure speculation.
Well, I have a couple of spies in studio too. They're both okay. Were ambassadors. That's what you guys did, is to get as much information as you possibly can for the Irish government.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Legally.
She adds.
By fair means or foul, I don't know. I wonder, because everybody is so polarised over President Trump, either they adore him or they hate him. You know, does the Washington Post or the New York Times consider at any point that this is in any way ridiculous? Like, it's not against the law to talk to an ambassador.
No, Brian, of course not. But this is, if you look at the context of this, this was in the context of James Comey had refused to give Donald Trump a pledge of loyalty. Now, the FBI, you know, whether or not they are, I know several people who work at senior levels in the FBI. They tell me they're all Republicans. They despise Barack Obama. They loathe the Clintons with a passion. So the FBI was never a natural foe of Donald Trump's.
Right.
So for him to be constantly dissing the FBI, saying they didn't know what they were doing, that they were incompetent, that they were partisan, that they were pro-Clinton, was frankly laughable. And then James Comey, who, if anything, you know, look, Hillary Clinton lost the election all by herself, and she did get more votes than Donald Trump, yes, but she didn't. Her election strategy was not a winning strategy, and she wasn't a great candidate, so Donald Trump won. But there was this question from the get-go about James Comey when he came out 10 days before the election,
yes,
saying we're reopening,
I remember that,
an
yes.
investigation to Hillary Clinton. So, you know, you cannot say James Comey was batting for Hillary Clinton, objectively, certainly. I haven't ever heard a Democrat say it. And then he refused to give Donald Trump an agreement to be loyal to him, which meant that he would basically do what Donald Trump said. And then he did say during a congressional questioning that an investigation had been opened into Donald Trump. What he never said during the election was that there was already an investigation into various Russian contacts, because he said he was trying to be apolitical.
Right.
So you yeah. put all that, Donald Trump was not justified in firing James Comey certainly not for the reasons that he said, which was that he didn't like how he handled Hillary Clinton. But the whole thing, there was a background, and I said you have to look at the context where right. Donald Trump was behaving very strangely as a candidate for presidency
yeah.
and as a president of the United States.
But he also has a history of money and getting into financial difficulties and not being able to raise
yeah.
money and going to this person for money and that person for money. And it might be all about the money rather than anything else. But speaking of money, the poor, misfortunate people that are not getting paid in the United States, just remind us how all of this came around. We're back to a wall.
This started back in December. Again, the context for this was that the Democrats had just gained control of the House and they were taking over on the 3rd of January. And Donald Trump had really a couple of weeks, I guess, to try and get the Republicans to sort out funding for his wall. He wanted $5.7 billion, which he still wants. And then there was an agreed amount between the Democrats and the Republicans of $1.3 billion, which would go to more technology, more border patrol, officers, yeah, and some money towards making these appalling detention centres more humane. So that was all agreed, and Donald Trump was ready to sign off on it. And then a couple of right-wing radio commentators, Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter, said, this is disgraceful, Donald Trump, you're letting down your base, blah, blah, blah. So Donald Trump, having agreed to all this, went, oh no, I've changed my mind, we're not doing this now, we're not agreeing to this, I want my $5.7 million. Now, he couldn't get it during 2 years of a Republican-dominated Congress, so I really don't know how he thought he was going to get it from the Democrats, because they were coming in with a mandate, and having picked up 40 seats in the midterm elections, to be tough with Donald Trump, not to be pushed around by him. And so Nancy Pelosi, who, you know, people are critical of her, but I will say she is a veteran negotiator. She is very skilled. She knows all about votes. She knows how Capitol Hill works inside out. Donald Trump doesn't, and he has no interest in knowing. So they said, okay, you know, knock yourself out. You're not getting this money. Now, the Democrats are being political for their own reasons. There is room for a compromise here, and it's not just Donald Trump. The Democrats could say to him, even now, you know what? We'll give you a couple of miles of your wall, but in exchange, we want you to stop turning away and intimidating asylum seekers. We want you to... They could give them a list of things they want. They could say, OK, do this, and we will give you, I don't know, 3 miles of wall, whatever, just enough for him to declare
and to save
some kind
face.
Of victory or to save face.
Yeah. Ray,
and with Donald Trump at the moment, it's all about saving face. But neither side trusts the other. And then Donald Trump has let people down on deals, both Republicans and Democrats, repeatedly before. He promised a DACA deal. He welched on that. He promised, you know, and as I said, people don't trust him. Even his own side don't trust him. His word on Capitol Hill doesn't mean anything. And this is where the Democrats are saying, we're not going to be fooled again. But also, a poll just came out this morning, a Washington Post ABC News poll, that showed that 53% of Americans blame Donald Trump for this shutdown. Only 29% blame Democrats.
Okay,
and,
can I just...
About, I think 13% blame both. So Donald Trump is carrying the blame for this. So the Democrats have no incentive.
So now they're delighted, I presume. But meanwhile, the people aren't getting...
Suffering,
yeah. I want to come back to studio here just for a second, Marion. You know, people here sneer about the wall, and he wants the wall, and it was very unpleasant, the kind of things he said about Mexicans. But you know, people in glass houses... When the Syrians were coming across the water and the desert and God knows where else, and when Angela Merkel gave them asylum, Saint Europe threw up barriers, threw up that awful barbed wire and stuff. Like, we do it ourselves and then we give out about others.
That's absolutely true. And Donald Trump, as a lot of politicians in Europe know, that immigration is toxic, much more toxic than it appears on the surface, because people are always afraid of being called racist. And so obviously he doesn't, and Marion will be much more expert now, but he doesn't want to alienate his base. And I would imagine at a local level in the United States, the wall is probably a popular idea. And just the same as, you know, Fortress Europe is a popular idea. The Italian government are essentially in there on the basis of their immigration policy. So I think, you know, it'll only be solved when it's in the political interests of both sides to solve it. And as Marion said, at the moment, the Democrats are reaping some reward from it. He's afraid of alienating his base. And until the politics are ripe for a compromise on the basis of giving him something, but not everything.
Mary, sorry, your view?
I can understand a government wanting to control its borders, but it's the way he's going about it. And it isn't just the wall or not a wall. That's for Americans to decide. It's the way people are being treated, which is for all of us to comment on. And we will all remember the scenes last year where children and parents were separated. Were they a threat to the security of the US? There was no proof ever advanced to show that they were. And it's this wall has become a symbol of something other than controlling your borders. It's become a symbol of exclusion.
How long can he run with it, Marion?
Well, you know, this is a good question, but I think what Mary just said there is a very important point. It's the symbol of what the wall stands for, because America is perfectly entitled on the face of it. Of course it is. It's a country. It's entitled to have a border any way that it chooses and to protect its borders. But there is a big race aspect to this, and this is where Donald Trump is locked in with his base, in that what they see is the wall. They see Mexico and immigration as the browning of America. This all goes back to white nationalism, and that's what they're against, and that's what they were against when I was at all those rallies where he'd say build a wall. It was keep out brown people, in much the same way, as you say, exactly as Europe wanted to keep out people from the Middle East.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of hypocrisy there. Now, just on the State of the Union address is on the 29th of January. They had better have a solution. Donald Trump had better have it solved by then. But also, right, two other things very quickly. The a lot of the transport workers, transport safety workers, are now phoning in sick. The people who work at airports to screen baggage and all that kind of thing, it's starting to have a really big effect. People, these workers take home about $500-$600 a week. They are not rich people. They don't have money saved. So, and they're being told to sell their stuff on Craigslist, to mow their neighbours' lawns.
Right.
You know, this is the advice they're getting. It's laughable. And Americans are very angry about that. But also, one other thing, the wall can't be built, because I've been to McAllen several times where Donald Trump was. I've been along the Texas border and spoken to dozens of landowners. They've all said they'll fight, that they will fight if they have to stop Donald Trump from taking their wall. These are ranch families and small farm families who have owned this land since the 1700s, 1800s, and they're all about remember the Alamo. They will not let the government take their land to build a wall on it. There are still legal battles going on since 2006 over that. Right. It will never happen.
Okay, Mary McKeown, thank you very, very much indeed. We'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme, and we are going to move on to matters musical. The song Let's Get It On was a massive hit for Marvin Gaye back in 1973, and now the Grammy-winning songwriter Ed Sheeran has been accused of ripping it off in his song Thinking Out Loud. Ed Sheeran denies any copying, but it's going to be down to a jury to decide whether the songs are too similar for it to be a coincidence. This is not the first case of alleged plagiarism in music, and Dave Fanning is here to remind us of a few more. But didn't we have one in the Eurovision here in about 15 years ago?
I'll tell you, we have one a lot, much more than you even... In fact, funny enough, the one that people don't know is the Irish one. Gilbert O'Sullivan, it changed the whole rule about 1972, Gilbert O'Sullivan was the most successful pop star in Britain. And he'd had two fantastic singles, Nothing Rhymes and Alone Again, naturally.
Yes.
He was just one of the greatest. And somebody stole his music, which is Biz Markie. Now, Biz Markie called himself the Prince of Hip-Hop. He was the clown Prince of Hip-Hop. He was a total idiot. But the point about it is, it was this
I
company...
I hope he's not listening. Yeah.
He knows he's an idiot. In fact, he made money out of being an idiot by the end of the 90s because he realised he was this clown prince.
I want no legal ears.
But the point
closed.
Is, it altered the landscape of hip-hop completely because everybody had to sort of change the rules, so they thought it was okay to steal bits and pieces here and there. He stole a bit of Alone Again, naturally, for a single of his, and the Gilbert O'Sullivan crowd won. So, like, it's funny that, like, it's an Irish thing that a lot of people don't know as necessarily. Obviously, the most famous is the one you might get a chance to hear now, which is George Harrison and the Chiffons. You see, George actually went to, like, the Chiffons had a single which is called, you know, from years ago, Be My Baby and all the rest of it. He's So Fine was the one that actually he ripped off. And when My Sweet Lord came out, the point about it is, he tried to say, look, I didn't know this, you know. And you have to ask which judge you have and what they might be saying. You know, if it copies the melody and the rhythm and the harmony, the drums and the bass line, as one judge says, that means you've copied. Or is it this thing, look, there's actually a word, cryptomnesia, with an M and an N in the middle, I can't even pronounce it, which is a memory bias when a forgotten memory, thought or idea is perceived as inspiration. And George was saying, look, I didn't know about this, I didn't. And he even went into the court with his guitar, and it didn't work. And the really weird thing is, the guy who broke up the Beatles, the manager at the time, Alan Klein, who was a member of the Mafia, and if he's listening, sorry about that, Alan, but he is. Point about it is that he went and bought the company that owned that song. So now when that song gets played, i.e. My Sweet Lord, George gets all the money, or George's estate gets the money from America and the UK, and he gets the money from all the rest of the world. He bought the company just so he could have the money for the song. It's amazing. Anyway, it's definitely ripped off. There's no question about it. George lost the case, and rightly so.
Right. And are you going to play a little bit of that?
Here's George Harrison, and here's the Chiffons together.
Yeah. My sweet Lord.
It's completely ripped off. There's no question about it, you know. Like, whether it was unconscious or not. I mean, like one judge
what
asked me.
Crypt.
Yeah, C-R-Y-T-O-M-N-E-S-I-A. I've no idea. But anyway.
Cryptamnesia.
Yeah, right. Okay. And there was one judge recently who said, you know, can a sound or a groove or a hook or a riff be enough to bring a legal kind of, the whole idea of gravitas to prove copyright infringement? Another is the ambiguity of unconscious creative ownership. There's no law. Anything goes. And in fact, the biggest sort of a recent years is not so much Ed Sheeran, although he's in about 7 or 8 all over the place.
And now tell me what's going to happen to him straight away. That is going to go to court. He was hoping.
Oh, God, yeah.
Well,
he had one before with Matt Cardle. He stole it. Imagine stealing a song from an X Factor winner. I mean, please, you know, should aim a bit higher than that. But anyway, Ed Sheeran took photograph and amazing.
Would
and
you please not say stole?
Sorry. Oh, sorry. Appropriated. Sampled. But that's what it is, because he was found guilty
inspired
of that one there.
By.
And it was settled outside of court. And the judge said it was 39 notes, note for note, in a row with those two songs. He's also written a song, The Shape of You, which is one of the biggest songs of the last few years. TLC are claiming that's theirs. That's the band TLC. And he's also got a song that he wrote called The Rest of Our Life for what do you call it, Tim McGraw and Faith Hill, and it's a rehash of an old, well, supposedly a rehash of an old country tune called When I Found You. But there's so many court cases going on with all of these things that the biggest one of the last few years turned into a circus, which is a song that I saw this band play on the very second time they ever played it, which was at the stadium in 1971, Led Zeppelin. And they played Stairway to Heaven, they played the night before in Belfast, by the way, the first time ever. And it came out on their next album, which was Led Zeppelin 4, one of the biggest selling albums of all time, about 40 or 45 million copies. And the point about that is quite simply that they stole it from a band who supposedly were supporting them at the time in 1968 before that, and that one's still going on. They won the court case a few years ago, but the court case is going back in again.
We'll have a listen. And that's still going on, did you say?
Well, I think, no, it's going to go back on, I think, because the judge made a bit of a joke out of the whole thing. Led Zeppelin won the thing, but the problem was the jury wasn't allowed to hear the two pieces of music. A guy came in and played the two of them on a guitar from the sheet music. And like somebody else is saying, that can't be right. So the estate of Randy California is the lead singer of the band Spirit, Taurus being the name of the song that it was supposedly appropriated from, sampled from, are going to bring them back to court again, I think. So it's not over yet. But there's so many of them out there. Like, I mean, Coldplay are one of the biggest ones of all. Viva La Vida is one that they supposedly took. And there's a guy called Joe Satriani. I don't know if anybody knows Joe Satriani, but he's a very famous guitarist who only does instrumental music.
Right.
In fact, he's the most successful rock instrumental music person in the world, over 10 million albums. But the funny thing is, his Viva La Vida was stolen. Or his song called If I Could Fly was stolen. And he looks at this song and he hears it on the radio. So, it was like a dagger through my heart. And most people say, no, it was like dollar signs in front of your eye, buddy. Because Joe was making more money out of this than he made out of any of his things.
Okay, caller says, please ask Dave how the juries decide on how similar the songs are. Is there a scientific element,
no,
or is it just opinion?
It's just whatever seems to happen. There's nothing written down in law. There doesn't seem to be anybody that can say anything. Because as I say, you know, if you give credit where it's... I'll give you a perfect example. Coldplay actually asked Kraftwerk, could they use the 9-bit motif from Kraftwerk's best song called... Computer Love, and they used it in a song which like was very famous, was huge, was on the album and made loads of money in that. And the fact that they asked Kraftwerk were so annoyed at Jay-Z ripping them off at the same time that they said, yes, good man Chris Martin, you're a good honourable man, we'll let you have it. So maybe asking beforehand might be a bad
idea.
It's considered polite indeed, it
certainly is. And I mean, the sums of money in these can be staggering. I was listening to somebody talking about Fairy Tale of New York in some programme over the Christmas Christmas and the amount of money that's made.
You know, the biggest one of that, like lately, is the Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke one, which was the big hit single of Blurred Lines. And they really were Blurred Lines when it came to court. And they said, no, it's ripped off from Marvin Gaye, from the estate of Marvin Gaye, who, of course, was shot dead by his father 30 or 40 years ago. So he wasn't involved. It was the estate. And they had to hand over Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams $7.5 million. There's an awful, there's huge monies in these things. Right. Yeah, huge.
Okay, well, listen, thank you indeed. When will we know the...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, well, let's get it go to court and see what happens. I mean, like, poor old Ed is in a lot of trouble with all these things, you know.
Okay, because he's got a lot of fans who would be very supportive of him. Anyway, I want to say thank you to everybody that contributed to the programme